Our first speaker this morning, for those of you who were here last night, you had a chance to hear him, and also over Shabbat, is Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, the Rosh HaYeshiva of Yeshiva Darchei Noam in Muncie, New York, and also the director of Project Yes. Rabbi Horowitz has produced, in conjunction with Art Scroll, a new book about children's safety and all that that entails, called Let's Stay Safe. I'm holding it up to you now. And has authored many other books and articles. This morning he is going to speak in a more expanded version on the themes of that book. So please welcome Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, everyone. Good morning, everyone. Nice to be back. I hope you find this helpful, informative, and I hope you're all spunky enough to give me some real feedback. And I'd like this very much to be an open exchange of ideas and thoughts about child safety. And let's get to it. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. You're hired. Now, over the past 8-10 years, we've come to grips with the fact that our community is not immune from what transpires in the world at large, and then we have our share of issues regarding child safety. And I think it's a healthy process where we get real about it and talk about what we need to do to keep our kids safe. I'm not going to spend that much time on the global issues, although I'll be glad to discuss them with you should you have any questions. You know, the general issue of reporting and our interfacing with the authorities, police, child protective services, as far as allegations are, what we need to do as a community. I'm going to speak to you right now as just as parents and grandparents, leaving open whatever you'd like to talk about the broader issues later. So I'm just going to talk to you about what you can do as parents, how child safety works, why it works, what the basic steps and messages are. And I'm going to walk you through a book that we published in conjunction with Art Scroll. We published it a year and a half ago. We, Baruch Hashem, with the help of God, we've gotten incredibly positive feedback. We sold over 19,000 copies of this book in a year and a half. And we've been very gratified by the fact that we keep getting, literally, no messing around, we keep getting messages from parents whose children were saved, literally. People made moves on them. The kids knew exactly what was going on, and they just spoke up. A few months, we released the book in August of 2011, and I did a workshop in Shalamis about 2 weeks after Hanukkah. Shalamis is a girls' high school in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and a woman came to the talk. She was actually not from the Shalamis parent body. She actually, you know, she was traditional Jewish, not observant. And I was like halfway through the talk, and she just jumped up and said, "Do me a favor, all of you." She pulled out a copy of the book. I said she's my sister-in-law as a joke, you know, but she pulled out a copy and she said, "Listen to me. I was in Eichler's. It's a popular store. I was in Eichler's picking up some Hanukkah stuff for the family, for our party. I just saw the book, and on a whim, I picked it up. I went to the website. I saw the rabbi's video that we produced. Parenthetically, we made a 32-minute video that's free, a free download. It's on my website. It's rabbihorowitz.com. And it walks, you know, it just walks. It's what I'm doing now, basically, explaining the background and how it works. Rather, you know, how the book works and what the logic that drove it was. Anyway, she said she read it to her kids, and her 6-year-old daughter was at the Hanukkah party that she had, and she said that her great uncle put the kid on her lap and started, you'll excuse me, started moving to her crotch area, you know, her genitals. And this girl looked at him and said, "You're making me feel uncomfortable. Stop that." Just exactly what it says, and started hollering. And then this woman broke down crying. And she said, "Rabbi, you saved my daughter's life. I can't thank you enough." She turned to everybody and said, "Listen, I don't know what world you're in, but this is real. I'm begging you, please do it." And that it is what it is. You know, we always thought that, I mentioned Friday night at we had a little talk on child safety at one of the homes here Friday night. And I mentioned at the talk, like where does the disconnect come from? Like, why do we think that we're immune from the world's problems? So I was interviewed by Sharon Adderman of the New York Times. She wrote a devastating two-part series. They were both started on the front page and inside two full page, I mean, enormous columns about the abuse in the Orthodox community. Not one of our more proud moments. So she interviewed me for the piece, and she asked me, she said, what's the gig? You know, why do you think that the Orthodox community is having a hard time coming to grips with this? So I told her, I said, it's much more, it's like kind of disbelief. It's a little more than denial. It's just like, so I told her, I said, look, if you go to McDonald's restaurant, they have a sign on the door that says, no tank tops, you have to wear shoes here, you know, right? They have the most minimal dress code. If you go to a fancy restaurant, I told the Tavern on the Green, it's a fancy restaurant in downtown New York. I said, if you go to Tavern on the Green, they don't have a sign there that says you have to wear a shirt here. Because if you're shelling out $200 a plate for dinner, you come in a coat and tie. Unless you're a Hasidic guy, of course, you don't do the tie. But, you know, but I'm saying, you know, it's understood that you come in with their cheretz for the restaurant, okay? So what I explained is, and I really believe this to be true, that what we thought of molestation in terms of a sin or something that's a bad thing that people do, rather than an illness, and rather than people it's pathological, they're just sick. So we said, well, if somebody's has restrictions on what they eat, which we voluntarily place upon ourselves, and we keep Shabbat, and we keep Kashrut, and we keep, you know, we have all of these, just count them, restrictions that we voluntarily put on our lives. We go on a vacation, and we brown bag it. You know, everybody's, you all know the feeling, right? You go on a vacation, and everybody's sitting there, you know, sawing away at their steaks, and you're sitting there, you know, having tam-tams there, right? You know, so we voluntarily do this because we believe in a code of practice that God divinely gave us, so a person who puts on tefillin every day and goes in a freezing cold day like today and bundles up to go to shul on Shabbat is going to sit and do that? Like, it just doesn't make sense. What we've come to understand slowly is that it's not a sin. It's nothing to do with religion. It's just a totally separate issue. So it's a human problem. It only becomes a Jewish problem when we think we're immune to it. I wrote that in a piece. It's called Human Problem. I have a number of articles. It's probably about 75 articles I've written over the years. I've been writing about it for about 11 years now, about the issue of abuse and what we need to do about it. So let's get to it. I think this is a great step forward that you guys put it on the program and spend some time, you know, talking and thinking about it. And I hope it'll, you know, every little bit helps. The education helps. The fact that you go home and talk about it, speak to your children, those of you who are grandparents, speak to your kids about speaking to your grandkids, do it gently. You know the grandparent thing. You just once in a while speak to your kids, not the in-law kids. You know the gig, okay? but get the message out. It's really an important message. So let's talk about why. What a child safety, a good research-based child safety program is about, how it works, and what the components are. Okay, so And as I said, I'm going to finish my presentation, and I really would like to hear from you all if there's anything that's on your mind. So let's talk about what are the components. What is a child safety program? A child safety program is speaking to your children in a way so that they understand that they have a right to their own privacy. That's, if you want the one sentence description, if you want the elevator pitch, that's the elevator pitch. A good child safety program, again, one that's research-based and that we know to work, is, in a nutshell, where you, as a parent, empower your children and say, sweetheart, this is your body, you're entitled to your privacy, you're entitled to your own space, and if somebody invades that space, speak up. That's really what it's about. The barriers to this is we kind of have a hard time understanding how can I train a 40-pound child to protect themselves against a 200-pound adult. It just doesn't make sense. There's other barriers to it. You say, my kids don't listen to me when I'm talking to them. How are they going to listen to me 6 months later? You know, so all of these things, these are legitimate concerns. You know, we talk to our kids, are they listening, they're not listening, they get it, they don't get it. So all of these things fly through our heads as we're talking to our children. The truth of the matter is that it does work. Why? Because children understand ownership at a very young age. You want to prove it? Go home, try to take away a lollipop, a passy, a blankie from a two-year-old. They understand that it's theirs. We haven't told them that they are theirs. And what often happens is quite to the contrary. Many of the good messages, important messages that we want our children to have, be respectful, be polite, be deferential to others, respect adults in your life, share, respect authority figures like rabbis and others and family members, all of these things when are a barrier to children protecting themselves. Now, you can have both. We'll talk about that. You should have both. They should be respectful and they should be sharing. But first, you know, it's mine and I'm sharing it with you. Okay, so that's how it works. And the nature of grooming, and I'm going to talk about that later, the nature of the way predators, the way we know now, and research tells us, and anecdotal evidence and careful study, there are a couple of great books. Dr. Ann wrote a fantastic book about how predators work. And if you just do a Google search, how predators work and you know, grooming process, if you're taking notes and you want to do a great, there's a fantastic article by Malcolm Gladwell, the guy who wrote Tipping Point, wrote an article about Sandusky and Penn State, explaining how he got away with it. And they describe the grooming process whereby a predator slowly, carefully, methodically, in a very evil and brilliant way, groom their victims from a larger pool, just like, I hate to say, just like you would go you would go pick an estrig for Sukkos Lahavdil, or pick a nice, a nice bouquet of flowers. You go in there and you say, well, this one's not good, this one's not good, this one's not good, that's okay. That's literally what they do. It's horrible, it's evil, but that's the way their brains work. They go to a pool of children, and they have 100 kids, and they say, okay, this one, that their parents come to, coaches, let's say, a football, Gladwell describes a football coach that would watch which parents come to practice regularly to drop off the kids. Okay, these are not good. Those parents are too involved. Then they would say, you know, slowly and carefully weed out. They would even go back to the parents. This coach was even going back to parents. He would not abuse the children, but rub their back, kind of halfway inappropriate. And then he would stop, go back to the parents, talk to them, and some of them would mention, you know, Joey said you were like rubbing his back, it made him feel a little uncomfortable. Okay, not that one, out. And then the ones that he got no response, they would continue to groom. And in fact, this situation, this unfortunate, I've been very involved in, there's a an Orthodox Haredi Jew in Williamsburg named Chemi Weberman. I've been very involved supporting the victim for over 7 months. He did the exact same thing. He was taking, you know, he was selecting his victims, which I found over the years, anecdotally, to be exactly the case. So how do you teach a 40-pound kid? A 40-pound kid doesn't have to punch back. He doesn't have to push, he or she. All they need to do is give them the look. That is enough, because they know that when they get a look like that from a child, when a mildly inappropriate advance is done, that means in their mind this kid has been spoken to. This kid knows that even like touching a chest area, or like if that look means I know, I get it, and I might tell my mother. So that's why it works. Okay, so I really empower you. I want to empower you and encourage you to get it, understand it, and then work with it and just stay at it and speak to your children. The research shows that one conversation with children, giving them these research-based messages with a moderate amount of follow-up, makes children 6 to 7 times more likely to exhibit defensive behavior when they're approached by a predator. So this stuff really works. So I'm going to talk about the 4 elements of child safety. I'm going to very briefly walk you through the book, and then I'm going to stop and take some questions for the rest of the time. And, you know, as I said, during the question, you can ask me the nuts and bolts of what we're talking about, the broader issue of child safety and how it works, or you can even digress to communal issues regarding child safety, and I'll gladly answer whatever's on your mind. So let's talk about the elements of child safety. So the first element is no secrets from parents, okay? No secrets from parents. To teach children that no one is ever allowed to tell them, this is between us. Don't tell your parents about this. I'm a school principal. It is wildly inappropriate for me to tell that to a child. Now, I can tell a child who comes to me for advice, if a middle school Talmud, a student of mine, a yeshiva, comes forward and says, look, Rebbe, I'd like to talk about something, and can we please keep this confidential? That's okay. But I should never initiate a discussion with him and say, listen, I'm going to talk to you now, don't talk to your parents. But that is, it is like one of the biggest red flags that something is really, really wrong. So no secrets from parents. And the corollary to that, the follow-up to that, is that you really, I encourage you all to have regular discussions with your children about their day, how their day was, how it went. Have an open relationship, which means you must be tolerant, because if you're going to have a real open relationship, they're going to tell you things you don't want to hear. And if you start admonishing them, or even if you start krachting, as my grandmother would have said. I always tell kids to talk to their parents. I remember a kid who was very significantly in trouble, a teen at risk, as we say. And I said, he was substance abusing, he was really getting into heavy, heavy trouble. And he was involved with a young lady way more than he should have been, and whatever. He was in a lot of trouble. So I said, why don't you talk to your parents about it? So he says, Rebbe, like every time, I love my mother. She's wonderful. But like, he didn't say it, but she doesn't get it. That's what he meant. Like, she doesn't get it. She doesn't understand my life. And then she says, he was adorable. He said, Rebbe, as soon as I tell my mother anything, she hears anything about anything that's not, she goes like this, and takes out a tillum, you know, a song. So he said, why am I torturing her? She's not going to help me anyway. So what? It's not that they don't like you. Sometimes it's that they like you too much. That's why I think parents should always tell their kids, if there's something going on in your life, I want to know about it, even if it's going to upset me. And to set up kind of some sort of policy with your kids where if your children tell you something on their own volition, they get a waiver. You can't punish them for it. And you really have to be, you really need to be, if this is a goal, and I think it's one of the most important things you can do as a parent, is to have this open exchange. It does not work if you're going to admonish them for what goes on. So message number one is no secrets from parents. Message number two, your body belongs to you. Okay? Your body belongs to you, which we spoke about earlier. Basically telling the children, you know, you can word this in many different ways. But basically what you're saying is you're entitled to your zone of privacy. And you know, have the conversation. You know, the good programs, you know, you can find, if you just go online, I'm telling you the four that I've come across, and, you know, I am not a licensed therapist. I never, ever, ever go there or do any counseling with children. I try to direct them to counselors and try to coach parents how to work with them. It's very important to maintain that line. But I've gotten coaching from some of the best, and, you know, these are the four that we found to be most effective. But there are others out there through Google searches. If you want to, if you're interested, on our website, which is kosherjewishparenting.com, there's a safety icon that has a picture of this book. There are over a dozen free downloads in terms of literature, some of the things that I'm telling you, free. There's videos. We actually hope to come out with a read-aloud version of this. I'm not going to say tape and book because I'll be dating myself. But, you know, we have there's an icon of this. If you click on that, you'll go into a lot of safety material that's all free. And I encourage you to take advantage of it or go elsewhere. Okay, so the second message is your body belongs to you. And again, the research shows that giving children any personal space of theirs at home helps them understand the notion of child safety. There's a stunning study that showed that, you know, a real professional double-blind study where kids, excuse me, they found that children who had their own drawer at home were more likely to stay safe than children who didn't. I mean, everybody has drawers, but meaning that this drawer is yours. It's private, and, you know, the other kids have to ask if they come into this drawer of yours or this space. Or even if you even talk to them about the notion of private space. We had an incident in our school a couple of weeks ago. One of the younger grades, there was some inappropriate touching among the kids. Yeah, my school too, right? Happens everywhere. Happens everywhere. The question is what you do about it. So I was thinking how to, you know, how to convey the message to the kids. And that's why I encourage you to be creative and think of different ideas. They're all good as long as you get this idea across. Excuse me. So I walked into class and I said, you know, guys, I have a new idea. I'd like to throw this out to you and tell me if you like it or not. I said, tomorrow, instead of hanging up your coats in the cubbies, everybody, we're going to put our coats in the corner of the room. And when you go out to break, anybody can take anybody else's coat. And we're going to do the same for snack. We're going to have a table set up. Everybody put your snack down. Anybody can take any snack they want. And same for books. We're all sharing. It's a big mitzvah. We're all going to share. Everybody's going to share everybody's thing. excuse me. I said, and if you really like it, we'll do it with Chanukah and Purim presents. So I said, let's take a vote. How many boys like the idea? Well, why don't you like it? Rebbe, I want my own coat. I want my own snack. I want my own. I don't like his snack. I don't like it. You know? Some kids thought it was a great idea. The ones whose mothers are giving them carrot sticks. You know? Okay? I'll trade you one Laffy Taffy for 75 zucchini bar. Whatever. Okay? So I asked the children, I was teasing, you know, I tried to elicit from them why they don't like that idea. And what emerged was they like their own stuff. So I said, well, you are your own stuff. And I wouldn't want you to be in a room where it's a mishmash and anybody can touch anyone else's body. That's worse than taking somebody's snack and taking their coat and taking that. So just like we have cubbies for your coats and your book bag for your snack, and da-da-da-da-da-da, we have desks for you. And everybody has a little personal space. I do to my yeshiva with with all the kids. I walk in the hallway when I see somebody. Everybody knows. My school knows what it means. I just go like this. No, I really, down the hallway, if I see stuff going on, I see kids, you know, I just make a little box with my hands. The kids all know what it is. Sometimes they back off. Most of the time they don't, you know, but I go over and tell them. But it's a visual. I just try to, I constantly try to get the kids used to this notion of their own personal space. Okay, that's the second thing. The third thing is good touching, bad touching. With third message, good touching, bad touching. Some touching is okay. You can touch someone's hand, you can shake their hand, you can pat them on the back, but certain touching is inappropriate. A good way to do this, a modest, sanua way, in a way that really works, and is probably the best thing to do, is parents say just any spot covered by a bathing suit is, you know, an inappropriate touch. So it's a nice, modest way to do it. It really won't get you bent out of shape. So that's the second. The third message, your body belongs to you. Good touching, bad touching, and it's very, very important to be very narrow when you list exceptions to the rule. Because I know it's hard to imagine, but most predators are people the kids know. They're relatives and kids on the block and friends of your other siblings that come over. It's usually people they know well. They know very well. Some of them are very charming. This idea of watch out for the weirdo in the raincoat doesn't work, because it's usually not the weirdo in the raincoat. So stranger danger is important. It's an important thing to tell your children, but in this area, as far as this is concerned, it's almost irrelevant, because most of the time the kids are not. Irrelevant is too strong a word. It's not helpful enough if that's all you're telling them. Okay, so it should sound something like, to a young child, no one's allowed to touch in a spot covered by a bathing suit except for mommy and daddy when we're bathing you, and only grandma and grandpa when we're away and they're bathing you, and a doctor during an office visit when one of us are in the room. By saying things like, nobody outside our family is allowed to touch you, you're really setting yourself up for big problems. So make that as narrow as possible. One other thing is that the talk should be in a very calm way. The research shows that when you bug out the kids, if you frighten them and they lose their menuchas nefesh, as we say in Hebrew, their sense of calm, they don't listen to what you're saying, which is why I'm speaking to you in a nice soft voice, and I didn't tell you one scary story. Listen, in a really practical way, if I wanted to get your attention when you walked in here, I would tell you two horror stories. I promise you wouldn't sleep tonight. But once I talk to you about these details, the research shows that you would not remember a single thing I said. You'd walk out and go home and say, somebody says, oh, how was that? What was the toza? Yeah, that's it. So what should you do to protect your kids? There's so many problems out there. So, you know, it's so bad. I heard a story. That's all you fixated on, because if you study Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I took away your security, so your mind can't comprehend other stuff, which is why we made this reader in a nice, friendly format, so kids can, kids can get these messages in a comfortable way. Okay, that's message number three. Message number four is the most complicated, which is why I left it for last. And that message is one to prevent grooming. We spoke earlier about the notion of grooming, that predators stalk their victims select their victims over time and very, very gradually encroach on their space. The fourth message is, you teach your children no one's allowed to make you feel uncomfortable. And if somebody does, speak up. Okay? No one's allowed to make you feel uncomfortable. And then you follow by explaining that if somebody does make you feel uncomfortable, you know, you could just run away or come to one of us. I was giving this talk to a group of very distinguished Haredi Rosh Yeshiva, and about 70 Rabbanim. And to his great credit, one of the Rosh Yeshiva raised their hand and said, Rabbi Horowitz, can you just explain this grooming thing a little bit better? So I was like quickly thinking of what I ought to do. So I asked him if I can do a demo with him, and he was very gracious. Can I ask you? Want to be a good sport? Okay.
You know, I'm always careful when I say, what do you do? I spend a lot of time on child abuse. I make sure to say protection after. Prevention. You know, this is not going to be. Yankee, okay, Nishli? First thing? Yankee, have a seat, please.
Okay, here's what we're going to do.
And this is important. This is the most important thing. This is the most important part of your morning. This talk, anyway. Because the other talks are fine. This talk, this is it. You know, you want to go all the way to the end, please? The closest, the furthest. Okay.
As far as
you can without falling off. Good. Okay. Now, what this component is, I'm going to show you how you would train the child. Let's think about spacing. What is called an you want to teach your child, if somebody's sitting next to you in an inappropriate way, the spacing is not right, speak up, run away. The problem is, look how close you two are. Okay? Look at you two. The last night we had 300-400 people in this room. Everybody was shoulder to shoulder. So you can't tell your kid nobody's supposed to sit shoulder to shoulder with you because you don't know what setting they're going to be in. In the New York City subway train, if you go during rush hour, you can pick your feet up and never fall down, right? You know, because everybody's back together. So it's context, which you can't explain. That's why it's so complicated. The other three are very, you know, are very objective. No one's talking, no secrets, and it's very easy. This is more of a feeling. And the research shows that even young children, God forbid, forensically, after they were molested, and they go back and talk about what happened in the past, the kids, most of them point to a time way before they were molested that they kind of felt weird. Sometimes they can't even explain it. So, let's look at this. Here would be the question. Imagine that we were upstairs in the shul, or let's say on a New York subway train. The mashal I gave this Rosh Yeshiva was, imagine the two of us were in an empty subway car. 11 o'clock at night, empty subway car. What would be an appropriate, let's say the car is from that pillar to that pillar, that's the size of it. What would be an appropriate place? Yeah, what's your first name?
Yaakov.
Put this chair where you would be think an appropriate placement for the tool, for me coming in. Put it somewhere on this,
right there.
Right there, fine. So if I sat down, let's say, what is this about? 8 feet? If I sat down, whoa! 8 feet minus one. Okay, so if I sat down 8 feet from Yaakov here on an empty subway car and just took out the paper and started reading it, no alarms would go off in your mind. So what I'm going to do is, let's imagine that I started out closer than 8 feet. And I'm going to gradually move my chair over. If Yaakov feels that this is like a little bit weird, as soon as you do, pick up one hand, please. Okay? When you feel it's really, really weird and creepy, you pick up both hands, please. Good? Yaakov, you got it? Okay. So here we go. Now, I walk into the car. Instead of sitting 8 feet away, see that? I didn't do anything. I can't even reach him. But he felt bugged out. This is why this is the most important part of it all. Okay? Right now he's okay, but he's starting to feel a little weird. Now I'm in his space. So, obviously, for many reasons, I chose not to do. This is a physical body going up like this, but this is a polite way of doing that. So I could just as well have shaken his hand and then held his arm and here, like, and probably like around here. Let's assume I went from here to a private spot. So this would be okay. This would be okay. This would be okay. This would be like kind of a little too much, and then one hand would go up and then like around here. So. Thank you very much. Great. Thank you. So give him a big hand. There you go. So this is what you got to do. You train your children that if you feel one hand uncomfortable, not two hands uncomfortable,
if you, as soon as you feel that one hand uncomfortable, get out, run away, and yell. Because, again, when I'm here, if I was in this situation, think of it. If I walked into the car when it was one hand and I sat down, he wouldn't feel the need to talk to me. He would just pick himself up and walk to the other car. But if I sit down right next to him, like he's going to say, I got to go. Like you feel more weird and more in this space. So that's the fourth message. If you feel uncomfortable, get out. The story I told you earlier about the mother in Shalamis, the woman who, for those who weren't here, I mentioned the story that, you know, shortly after this book was published, a woman came to a workshop I did in Shalamis in Brooklyn and raised her hand and thanked us for publishing this book that she spoke. She never thought she would need to, but she had it. She picked it up in a bookstore. She spoke to her daughter. And at the Hanukkah party, a week or two later, a great uncle of hers started fondling her 6-year-old daughter. The daughter knew exactly what was going on and yelled, "You're making me feel uncomfortable," and ran to her mother. And then she broke down and thanked me for saving her daughter's life. So, I'm going to walk. If you're interested, these books are for sale outside. There's whatever is left. If you want to step up and get one now, that's fine. I'm going to walk you through it. If you'd like to, that's fine. You can pick them up on the way out. You don't have to pick them up. Whatever works for you. If you're interested, I'm going to walk you through it. So, basically, the idea is we started with general child safety. Again, the young ladies have them outside if you're interested. We purposely started with general child safety, helmets and other stuff, so that you could have this a pleasant conversation with your kids, so you don't get bugged out. We wanted to do this in a way where it's purposely designed, very kid friendly. It's just a nice, relaxed book. You know, this starts like a little bit of stranger danger. Don't go out to a car if you don't know. See who's knocking on the door. And here we start on page 14. It gets to the meat and potatoes of actual child abuse. And now that you're familiar with the basic messages, you can see what we were trying to get across in this. Can you see some part of it at all? Yeah, okay. So you can see here we have, like, this kid is saying, this is my ball, this is my teddy bear, this is my room, this is my private area, to enforce the notion of privacy. I got my own knapsack, my drawer, my private space. I keep lots of stuff in its own special place. My body is also private. Some of it stays covered. Okay? This was the trickiest page because this was really the grooming page. And just, you know, it took us 2 years to do this. It was an incredible labor of love. I'm the ideas guy. I didn't do much of this. My wife and some others, we had two professional therapists who read and reviewed every page. Four Rashi Yeshiva on the Meitzes Gedolei Torah, four of them Haredi Rosh Yeshiva who are universally respected in the yeshiva world, reviewed every word and every page, and at my behest, I asked them to. And, the Aguda and Torah Masorah and Outsprawl, you know, all gave, we Baruch Hashem, we've gotten complete, acceptance of this completely. They were actually very supportive. This picture was trickiest because we're trying to show the grooming process. And what we're saying is, even someone who looks like you, we wanted it to look like the kid's uncle. So even someone who looks like you and is doing fun things with you, it says here, being with grown-ups is lots of fun. I learned to fry a kite. Even someone we know and like very much shouldn't touch us in ways that we don't want to touch. That's the grooming piece of it. The next two pages go on past events, encouraging children to speak to their parents. You see, it's a winter scene here, and this is a summer scene. So encouraging parents to speak to the kids about stuff that happened a long time ago. And the final two pages, this actually shows, you know, running away. We did like a motion, we, graphic artist, did a motion figure running away from this one who's trying to give him candy. I'll tell mommy and daddy if somebody wants to offer me a treat, you know, someone I don't know, and if he tells her to go. And this is about talking to your parents. You know, the child going home and talking to parents. The rest of it's about regular child safety. So this is a tool. You could use it. You could not use it. That's up to you. But the idea is, again, to facilitate a rich and interactive discussion about child safety, about the personal space. And as I said before, it's extraordinarily effective. So I really encourage you to have these conversations. And empower you to do what you can to keep your kids safe. Thank you very much. I'll take some questions now, please. Whoever, but let's do what we did last night. Line up, please, in front of that microphone. Can I ask you, the few of you, to just make some space there. Line up in front of the microphone and fire away. If you ask me a question I'm uncomfortable answering, if I look at my watch and say it's about time for us to break, you'll know that. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Are we inadvertently setting up some problems by Candyman in shul? Kids know exactly where to go. They have a schedule. They have a map. They know exactly. Is this something we should be thinking about?
So the answer is, thank you for asking. I think a Candyman is perfectly appropriate, provided that it's in a public area. Everybody knows who it is. I don't think we should stop doing things that we've been doing. We just need to be careful and set boundaries for them. For example, a good professional code of conduct, code of practice in a school would be that teachers or any educators should not be giving gifts to children, prizes, if there's no pattern to. In other words, if you say, if you score this grade on a test or if you help another student, you'll get this, that's okay. But you shouldn't be favoring one child over another, and it should be in a transparent way. Okay, so people ask me, what do you think about going away to summer camp, for example? I say, go. Send your children. You can't keep them in a closet. It doesn't work. It's not healthy for them. They have to live life. You just have to be smart about it. Okay, thank you for asking. Please.
Very impressive, the work that you're doing and the way you're presenting it to all of us.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
I can't help thinking that it's perhaps treating the symptom, not the disease. How do these people become this way? How can the community prevent these type of predators?
Excellent. Okay, that's an excellent question. Thank you. So I felt, this is my own thing, about 4 years ago, you cannot imagine what I listened to in the course of a week. It's just, I decided to channel all my frustration and pain over listening to these horror stories into something positive. I feel, in my opinion, that the most effective thing that we could do is to train the children. It is true that the broader issues that you bring up, how can we do it, that's a very important component. We chose to focus on education. But how do people get like this? Many of them kids who were molested as children and not received professional care are far more likely to molest others. Unfortunately, the recidivism rate of, once they're predators is terrible, is very low. Usually, this is a desire that they'll have for the rest of their life. Hopefully, it can be managed. So, and how can you find them? You absolutely cannot. If you're interested, do some studies. There were two people who spent 20 years going around to prisons interviewing predators to try to find the pattern. And they, in frustration, they threw up their hands and said, there is no pattern. Some of them are the most, they're rich and poor and handsome and, not that handsome, well-educated and illiterate. There's no pattern. So therefore, the only thing you can do, really, not only thing you can do, the best thing you can do is to educate your kids because they're the ultimate, that's the first line of defense. If you're interested, by the way, you want to watch a fantastic video. There's a chief, Michael Bruno. If you do a search for his name, Michael Bruno is the head of the Tenafly Police Department. And I did a talk with him, Chabad. Chabad has a website. It's chabad.org and a television station. They asked me to do a secular version of this talk without mentioning God's name once, to make it for a secular audience. So I said, I got to speak to people. I can't do. They said, I can send the camera crew to the house. I said, give me some people. So I said, put me in front of a secular audience. I went to Tenafly, New Jersey. The chief of police, Michael Bruno, spoke. He was magnificent. One of the things that he said four or five things that I never heard in my life that were brilliant. I encourage you, just do a Google search, Chabad, Michael Bruno, Horowitz. The two names of ours together, it'll come up right away. But what he said, one of the things he said that was brilliant was that he said that parents and children, we need to focus on the it, not the whom. The it is the action. The whom is who did it. and I was explaining Friday night, we tend to layer both together and then make a decision. Let me give you an example. If one of you went up to the shul and you saw Rabbi Karupkin taking single dollar bills out of the pushka, you would say he put in a 20 and he's taking change. Why? Because you trust him and you like him and he's a respectable person. So you would not suspect that he's stealing from the charity box. However, if it was an unsavory looking character, you would scream, hey, get your hand out of the pushka, right? That's what we would think. Because what did you do? You factored in what happened and who did it. And you make a... Because abuse is such that you can't know who's a predator, you have to ignore the whom and say, what if the whom was the worst, most unsavory person? Would I suspect this or not? So if you see someone giving lessons in a private room together and you say, I wouldn't let an unsavory person do that, don't let the Kohen Gadol do it. You know, you don't let anybody do it. If it's not right, if the it is not right, out. Did I answer your question? Thank you. Please.
Okay, I have two questions.
Please.
First of all, is a kid that was bullied more susceptible to getting molested?
Excellent question. Go ahead.
And I worry about high school when the kids go out and dorm and they don't call you every night or even if they're out of town. What's the situation there?
Okay, excellent. I consider bullying, thank you for asking, I consider bullying to be like a little mini abuse. It really is. In fact, a lot of the bullying, the abuse, the experts say that it's really not about the actual, you know, the sexual part of it. It's much more about dominance and force and like a really an evil desire to enforce their will on someone else. So bullying I don't know any research I'm not qualified to answer the question if a bully victim is more likely to be abused, but logically it would seem that it would be because, you know, their space is being invaded in a more moderate way. That's why I'm very opposed to parents hitting children. I'm begging you. If you do it, please, it's okay if you're doing it. It's not okay, but it's okay if you go for help. If you're a parent and you're hitting your child, this stuff really doesn't work. Because you're telling your children, no one's allowed to make you feel uncomfortable. If you're hitting them, you're making them uncomfortable. So you can't, it doesn't work. It actually doesn't work. It's much less effective. And if you are doing it, sometimes, you were raised like that, and it's hard to get it out of your system. Go for professional guidance on how to do it. A true story. And again, all of this cuts across all lines. It's not limited to any segment of the population, orthodox, not orthodox, right wing, left wing. We all deal with this stuff. I'm dealing with a couple whose marriage is breaking up because the husband is hitting the kids and the mother is going crazy, understandably so. I swear to you, this is the exact conversation that they had. I spoke to the dad and he knows things are breaking up. And I asked him, I said, listen, you know, this is not healthy for your children. Please go for help and learn how to do it. And I kid you not, he said, we know each other since childhood. And he says, Yankee, he says, you know, my father beat the beep out of me. It didn't hurt me. You know, why should it be a big deal? I wasn't harmed by it. Nebuch, not realizing that, you know, so I have a... In Parshat Mishpatim, in 2 weeks, I wrote a Dvar Torah about abuse and why God told us to be nice to strangers. We're admonished 36 times not to abuse, not to be nice to... It doesn't mean only converts. It means people who are, you know... And my thinking is that God told it to us. It says, don't do it to others because you were in Egypt. You were... So the literal understanding, the way Rashi says, is... You were strangers in Egypt. You know what it feels like. Don't do it to someone else. I'd like to suggest, I wrote there, that I think God is telling us because we were abused in Egypt as a nation, we're more likely to abuse others. We're in a danger. We're in a risk. We're in a high risk factor of abusing other converts and other people because, okay, so I have a horrible cartoon there. Again, if you want to look it up, just Yaakov Horovitz Mishpatim, it'll come up. There's a horrible cartoon of a father pulling his kid by his ear. And you see the father, one ear is bigger than the other, you know. And this is unfortunately a gift that keeps on giving. So, you know, you really have to stop the cycle. If anybody's listening to this recording or if you hear, just it's if he is doing it, just stop and go for help. It's the most, it's so important. So that's number one. There are some excellent anti-bullying programs that I would encourage you, if you're involved in a school, politely and respectfully try to encourage the school staff to do. We just signed up for a program in conjunction with Yeshiva University. There's a Dr. Rona Novick that has a BRAVE program. If you're interested, you can do some homework on it. She's fantastic. I'm very proud. We're the first all-boys yeshiva in the country to sign up there. She's already done this in schools with 8,000 children in the aggregate. So there are good anti-bullying programs, and I would encourage you to think about it. Finally, about the dormitory business, I do not recommend dormitory schools. So I'm in my own yeshiva. I know sometimes, you know, look, hopefully you have to train your children. It's really like summer camp on steroids. You know, it's just, you know, your dormitory is summer camp squared. But you have to train your kids. But I'm, you know, not only for that reason. I think parents should raise kids, not schools, and I'm the head of the school. So you got to speak to your kids if they're in dormitory, just like you would any other way. And maybe it would be helpful to speak to the school, just like I encourage parents about summer camps. Speak to the head of the camp and ask them, what are your policies about, you know, do you have policies and procedures in place to prevent, you know, who do people talk to if there's a problem? And if they give you an answer, well, we speak to our staff and me then, and I'm the person, and we speak to the kids about it, and da-da-da, fine. If someone tells you, it never happens here, run for the hills. Okay? Yes, please.
You keep saying young children. Can you quantify how young you can start with kids?
I think two. I think you can start at the age of two. We found this book to be helpful already with two-year-olds. All right, my grandchildren, but they're smarter than most other kids, you know. You know, but we found two to be helpful. We also find we get a lot of questions about adolescence. You know, you're not going to sit down with your teenager saying, like, whatever, you know, and start reading this book. But what we have found very helpful, what I found, is if you just drop this book on the coffee table, don't say a word to your teenage kids, and they pick it up, and you say, hey, what do you think? I'm thinking about getting this for my nephew, or I'm thinking, what do you think about the book? They'll usually read it, and you'll be able to have a great conversation with them. Okay? Yes, please.
Thanks for your presentation.
Thank you.
I don't think you've mentioned sufficiently for me what I read a lot about are the greats. You mentioned the Weber instance.
Yes.
The enablers, the gedolim, the great leaders of our people who are looked up to by hundreds of thousands of Jews who are demonstrating that they're poo-pooing this, that they're covering it up in every fashion they can and enabling the perpetrators. On another issue, I just want to mention to everybody, in Ontario, every adult, whether you're in the business, a physician, a doctor, a neighbor, it doesn't matter what, if they see any signs of abuse, is obligated immediately to call an agency. The police is easiest, Children's Aid Society outside the community, Jewish Child and Family Services, but it's a personal obligation by Ontario law based on a suspicion, not evidence. You don't go to the Rav, you don't go to the parents, you don't go to the kid.
You make a call. Don't pass go, no, right. Don't collect $200.
And we all need to know that and hear it all the time.
I agree. Thank you very much.
What is going on in our schools to train the teachers for this?
So I thank you very much for the second comment. As far as the first comment, I think it's time to go. So let me tell you, I personally have consistently said for over 10 years now that people should go directly to the police. Time has demonstrated that we just do not have the capacity. We, rabbinic people, do not have the capacity to decide which allegations are true or not. We don't have supervisors. I can't force anyone to come to me. Someone comes to me in Muncie and says, you know, so-and-so has... He's acting kind of weird and this. So, all right, let's come over to my house. Let's talk about it. He's going to go fly a kite. What am I going to do? I'm not going to give him kugel at the next kiddush. I mean, what am I supposed to do to him? So I can't supervise. I don't have time. I don't have staff. I don't have training. It just doesn't work. So I've always, I mean, not always, but over 10 years now, I've been saying and writing to go straight to the authorities. One thing is clear. I just want to point out that every single rabbinic figure that I've ever spoken to says that in a case of a clear molestation, if the kid comes home and says, so-and-so touched my private parts, or there's a clear molestation, there's been a clear psakim across the board, there's been rabbinic rulings that they should go directly to authorities. Where it gets kind of gray is what happens if somebody comes along with, like, acting kind of weird. I'm not sure. It seems to be. So there are many rabbinic figures that do say go to the authorities, come to us, and we'll decide if it's it's a reasonable allegation. And look, all I can tell you is what I think is what needs to be done, and the fact that as our community gets more educated about it, I hope more of it will change. That's just the way it is. It is what it is. You know, typically, I mentioned Friday night that a lot of it is culture, and some of it has to do with upbringing. The people in our community who were raised in Europe, we're going to the authorities, meant death. I mentioned it to the New York Times reporter when they called me about this whole abuse issue. I said that I mentioned a story that I don't have the time to go into that right now, but in Europe, when the authorities came to the door, people literally went around and benched their children and said goodbye to the family and left. So it's very hard. It's a cultural thing. It so happens the younger Dayanim, even in the Hasidic world, the younger, I mean my age, are much more likely to send to the authorities, and most of them are. But it is what it is. I appreciate your candor. I answered as much as I'm going to, but it is what it is. Look, it's clear history has proven and shown demonstrably, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that it does not work when other people, get involved, and we kind of have people looking into it and all that. I got to say, the authorities aren't perfect. There are mistakes that they make, and you know something? I think to a great degree, rabbinic figures have an extraordinarily important role in this in terms of education. And even when they get out, someone's a predator, they come out of prison, they're in the community. What are you going to do about it? Right? The authorities can't protect unless there's another action. So I'm saying I think rabbinic figures have an extraordinarily important role to play in some of these things. But as far as investigating and supervising, I think it has to be authorities. Anybody else? Do you have a question? Please. I think we're just about at the end of time. Is that right? Is the next session going to be in here? Last two questions, please.
When I was growing up, the whole subject of abuse was a non-issue. My parents had a store. We lived downtown. Very, very unsavory people came into the store. They bought me ice creams, took me for walks. It was a non-issue. Is this a new phenomenon in the last 50 years? I mean, did this go on centuries and centuries ago? I know it's a difficult question to ask because you don't know what went on centuries and centuries ago.
Well,
but
actually,
if it's in fact a new phenomenon.
I'm a lot older than I look.
I know. I wasn't going to mention that.
Now, Abe Lincoln, there was a president.
Okay, all right.
I'm sorry.
Abe Lincoln, I remember when there's no electricity. Okay. But the question is this.
Great. Your question is excellent. So let me tell you.
You know what I'm saying.
So until 40 years ago, 40, 45, 50 years ago, there was no understanding. It was a very limited understanding in the general population about the harmfulness of abuse. And it's interesting, in rabbinic literature, we don't find no psukim about abuse. They have them. If you look at the Noda B'Yehuda, 500 years ago, there are rabbinic responsa about the strangest and, sins that people were committing. I'm not going to go into it now, but it's pretty graphic in discussions of questions that are worse than this, I'm saying. So it's not that the rabbis didn't want to talk about stuff like this. It just was not understood. The harm, it was not understood in the general population. And, as the information started getting around to the general population, many of us, or most of us in the Orthodox world, said, thank God we don't have to deal with that here. Right? We don't have that here. So that was the reaction, which is costing us lives now. But I'll tell you a theory I have. Take it as you wish. I think to some degree, may sound strange, I think it's because we have an enhanced level of comfort and security today. Again, this is my own thought. I think it's more jarring for children who live in a normal, safe society to get abused. It's so much more disruptive to them than it was 50 and 100 years ago when people were never safe. You understand? Every sin in the world, I believe, has been going on since the beginning of time. You look in the Torah, it talks about some pretty, stuff. So I don't believe, oh, the generation, the internet, da 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 da. I don't believe it. It's always been going. Stuff has been going on, in my opinion, since the beginning of time. I think the fact that there is so much sexuality out in the general culture probably makes it worse. Again, no research. I'm saying my own thinking is that it makes it worse. You look at a picture of a baseball game 50, 70 years ago. Everybody, you know, came in a coat and tie. People didn't come and say, with a T-shirt, I'm with this jerk, you know. I mean, you know, people... So, you know, people... So I'm saying the sex in all the ads and all the culture and everything that's out there and the internet, it fuels this. So it would stand to reason that people are more wired, you know, than they would be. So I would imagine that that's worse, but I think it's always gone on. If you study Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you ask yourself, how safe did a child feel in Europe 75 years ago, the answer is they didn't. And even in a much diminished way, I grew up in Bell Harbor, Queens. I rode the bus home every day by myself from Yeshiva, from Brooklyn. And I regularly used to get pounced upon on the bus. My yarmulke was stolen. You know, there were kids in the neighborhood. I mixed it up. I gave some, they gave some. Yeah, there were less of me, so I usually got more than I gave. But today, it would be front page news. Racial epithet hurled at Yeshiva student, right? I came home. I told my mother, Ma, they found me the bus. Listen, you know, I love my mother. I love her to death. But the attitude was, all right, you know, it happens. You know, deal with it. I'm sorry? That's life, right? Isn't that correct? We were raised, our generation was raised, basically, stuff happens, deal with it, you know, and not that they didn't love us, the parents didn't love us any less, but it was a different world. So therefore, in today's climate, where Baruch Hashem, people, our children and grandchildren are growing up really in safety. So when someone comes along and messes around with them in such a nasty way, I think it's just that much more harmful. I have no way of proving it, but just a thought. Okay? One more, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I think we need to carry it a little further and encourage our kids to say no to any situation, not just touching that makes them uncomfortable. And I'll give very quickly a true story. A friend of mine, her son, who was about 15, they live in New York, he almost died of alcohol poisoning because when he went collecting on Purim, every balbais that he went to,
they
insisted that he take a drink. And this kid never had drunk in his life. So he went to several places. He couldn't say no because he was a sweet, obedient kid. And at each house, he took a little drink, and they found him passed out in the stairwell, and they had to rush him to the emergency room. So what I'm trying to say is we have to teach our kids just to say no to anything that they don't want to do.
I agree 100%. In fact, one of the things that I tell, I mentioned Friday night that I think grandparents, I see, you know, Kanahara, there's quite a few grandparents in the audience, Kanahara. I think we can play a very important role by teaching or by telling our grandchildren when we horseplay with them and give them, act like fools, which we all do, of course, with our grandkids. It's helpful to tell them if we're doing something that makes you feel uncomfortable, just tell us and we'll stop. I think it's I do it with our own grandchildren. And in fact, on the video that's on my website, I mentioned, you know, a story that happened with our own grandson where I was reading The Three Little Pigs to him. And, you know, huff and puff. And when the kids were young, I used to blow on their faces and watch their hair fly. I always tell our grandsons, Dovi, if there's some things Ivy does that you don't like, just tell me to stop and stuff. So I read the story to him a second time over the same yontif. And two pages before the huff and puff part, he taps me on the hand. He says, Ivy, I don't like when you blow on me. Please don't. He said it very respectfully. So, you know... of course, I didn't do it. Sometimes, you know, you give these kids the wet kisses, you know, the anaklach, and they say, so don't do it anymore. Kiss them on the forehead. If they really don't like it, you're giving them such valuable training that even someone like you that loves them and da-da-da-da-da still has, you. They have the right to tell you. I think it's an extraordinarily important point for grandparents. Just two things I didn't mention last night because there was so much going on. We had an open forum, a discussion of kids at risk and da-da-da. There was a lot of talk about Gemara and about how the disconnect of some kids not doing well in Gemara winds up being a terrible barrier to Yiddishkeit because as the yeshivas learn more and more Gemara, this becomes an issue. So I just wanted to mention that Project S, one of the things we identified as a very big risk factor is kids not getting entry-level Chumash and entry-level Gemara, not picking up Hebrew and Aramaic. Teaching children Gemara without teaching them Aramaic, or at least giving them an introduction to language, is really the equivalent of learning Shakespeare in Latin, where you have a limud, so to speak, a subject that you're studying without giving them language skills. And then you say, but I don't know Latin. Learn Shakespeare. You'll pick it up. Just think about it. You would never do this in any other setting. You would introduce the children to Latin and then start Shakespeare, or start Shakespeare with a dictionary next to it. Okay, we would never do this. So we've been in Project S. This is something that we have identified. You know, we got, I wouldn't say sidetracked, God forbid, but we started doing this about 5-6 years ago. I've been developing this in my yeshiva over 15 years. We identified this as an enormous risk factor, and we've been creating classroom materials for introductory Chumash and Gemara, where we break up, you know, prefix and suffix and teach in Hebrew and teach children language. There's some really nice workbooks. I'm biased, of course. There's a Chumash workbook that we published, and we actually have a pre-Gemara program. We do it in my yeshiva. We have a 5-month pre-Gemara course, so to speak, where the children learn 100 most commonly used phrases, background, where it came from, how the slang of Gemara works, how the give and take, how deductive reasoning works. It's a very slow, it's a 5-month program. Our fifth graders now are just starting Gemara after the midwinter break. So if any of you are involved in schools or you have children that are struggling with either Chumash, Hebrew, or Aramaic and Gemara, I'll be outside. I don't want to disturb the session here, but I'll be glad to show you some of the material. I have one or two Chumash books with me. We published the first book. If you'd like to find out more about the curriculum materials, I'll be outside. Thank you very, very much, everyone.